KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
My grandmas and my grandpas and my mother made sure that I was to be proud of the blood that courses through my veins.
If I just know that you share a rare surname with someone who was wealthy in 1800, I can predict now that you're 9 times more likely to attend Oxford or Cambridge.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own.
Today on the show, this hour, Orson Welles, The War of the Worlds, what that meant for radio, what that meant for the nation when that broadcast took place. Also, what's in a name? We're going to find out, well, maybe more than you want to know. But we're going to start out taking a look at the Seattle Police Department and drones. Seattle Police are inviting the public to see and talk about drones from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Garfield Community Center. The unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, can range in size from a jet to a hummingbird. Privacy groups like the ACLU have expressed some concerns. Sergeant Sean Whitcomb is the Public Affairs Director for the Seattle Police Department. Sergeant Whitcomb, thanks for talking to us again.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So, when will we be seeing these drones, if we can see them, flying around our areas?
Oh, it's going to be some time. So, the purpose of the meeting tonight really is to get feedback from the community about this program. We've had the program here for some time, largely in just developing it and training officers in the use of these unmanned aerial systems. I mean, they're like really fancy remote-controlled helicopters, if you can imagine that. And there's been some news coverage on that already. This is going to be an opportunity for community members to actually see them in person and kind of get an idea for the size, the look, how noisy it is or not, because they're very quiet, and demystify them, so to speak.
So if you've already been training people on them, does that mean you may have already deployed them for some experimental purposes? Where have they been deployed so far?
Indoors largely, and we had a limited use opportunity where we've taken them out to Discovery Park.
And so they gathered some tape. You got to determine how well they worked.
How well they worked. It's a very small device. It's called the Dragonflyer. It basically is designed to go up in the air, pretty much straight up, not very high, and be in visual contact with the operator.
So tell me how these will be used once they are deployed. We have a list here from the from your own guidelines, but overall, how are they going to be deployed?
So the beauty of this is that's not decided yet. We actually are really going to rely on community feedback to help guide us in how these things will be used. What we envision the potential uses as really crime scene photography, searching for missing persons, and barricaded situations where there may or may not be hostages. So people hold up in homes or businesses, and those generally result in a SWAT team call out and a lot of other police equipment, including our bomb squad bomb disposal robot. So this just gives us added capability. And what we want to hear from the community is, are there any other uses? Are these uses too much? What would the potential impact be if we operated these pieces of equipment in these manners? We already have capabilities of doing everything that I've listed. They're just limited, and sometimes they rely on other agencies. Like, for instance, we've called on the King County Sheriff's Office helicopter, Guardian One, to come in our city and help us out on certain things. And this would make us a little bit more independent and a little bit more nimble when it comes to responding to certain incidents.
Will they ever be used for surveillance of suspicious people at suspicious corners?
Absolutely not. I mean, the draft guidelines that we've come up with on our own as kind of a scope of mission here is incredibly narrow and very limited, and ultimately could be even more limited depending on feedback from the community. So the idea of just having these eyes in the sky, it's a little more than coincidental that you brought up George Orwell. We just really don't envision that, and we don't have a use for that. This whole point is to make our jobs easier and safer.
Well, you know, but the Seattle Police Department guidelines state, when the UAS is being flown from the onboard camera will be turned so as to be facing away from occupied structures, etc., to minimize inadvertent video or still images of uninvolved persons. Expand on that for me.
Yeah, so we want to make sure we're not accidentally looking at anything. So if we're going into a situation, let's fast forward in time, first of all, right? We've got permission from the FAA to use these. We've got buy-off from the community, number one, and then number two, our electeds at the city council and the mayor's office to use these pieces of equipment. So let's say all those have been satisfied and we're deploying it, let's say, at a traffic fatality, so our traffic collision investigators can get evidence of the scene, the collision site. So we'll be taking this device and putting it up in the air to get an aerial photograph. And, of course, this is a city, so there's probably going to be homes or businesses or high-rise buildings. We're going to want to make sure that people don't feel like they're being watched, so that the camera is not going to be pointed outward until we're above what we need so we can get that photograph. So we're being sensitive to people's concerns. And furthermore, we want to make sure that we're doing it properly.
If the drone is flying along and it sees inadvertently sees a crime taking place, is that legally admissible information?
I don't know how that would actually happen in the way that this is conceived. I mean, I suppose it's quite possible that we're out in a park looking for someone who suffers from Alzheimer's, and we see on the thermal someone being physically assaulted or beaten. I think that's kind of a no-brainer where we would deploy our officers to say, well, we didn't find the missing elderly person or the missing child that ran away from home, but what we did find was someone being physically assaulted, so we would more likely than not send in real humans to investigate that.
What are the rules, Sean Whitcomb, for helicopters and what they can see from the sky, and how do they relate to drones?
You know, it's been so long since SPD, and it's been decades since SPD's had a helicopter program, so I'm not the best person to ask for that. But I know that it's very specific and restrictive, especially over urban areas, and all guided by the FAA, as is this program with our UAS, so or UAV, or even drone. So, like, for instance, one of the concerns that we've heard is, you know, we don't want you guys taking this piece of equipment and using it to spy on the public. Well, one potential application, of course, would be demonstrations. We don't want SPD sending this device up to see who's demonstrating and to get pictures of that. And, of course, we can't, based on FAA rules, set it up over an area where there are people. So we're actually strictly prohibited outside of even our own policy from even doing that in the first place. So the point becomes moot.
So that won't happen.
It wouldn't happen. It can't happen. What's policy aside, even if people said that's a great idea, you guys should do it, we still wouldn't have permission from the FAA.
Of course, the part of this is ongoing, of course, right? The FAA may change its own guidelines as these become more ubiquitous.
You know, I suppose that's possible. I kind of doubt it just because of the liability if there were some type of issue. I mean, it's equipment, right? It's basically a remote-controlled helicopter. So and it's got a really short battery life, 10 minutes, a really short battery life. So it's not going to be out and about buzzing around. It's going to go up, do what it's intended to do, and come back down. And the idea of having it over people, it just presents an unnecessary hazard.
So, Sean Whitcomb, that statement, the battery life, limited by battery life of less than 10 minutes, an inability to carry more than 35 ounces, but 10 minutes battery life, given that, what can it possibly accomplish in 10 minutes, given the hazmat situation or a barricaded person, traffic collisions, what can it accomplish in 10 minutes?
Exactly what we need it to. So if our purpose going in was to make our jobs easier in those situations that I've outlined, then 10 minutes is ample time. And of course, this is Seattle. This is the Seattle Police Department. We're very sensitive to community concerns and privacy. We've been through this before with red light traffic cameras. So we went in specifically wanting this type of equipment that had a limited capacity for being in the air, because we figured, and probably correctly, that this should assuage some concerns that the device would be up longer than it needed to be. And specifically, just to take crime scene photographs, you don't need to be up that long for it. You need to send it up, snap, 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 bring it back down. And if those pictures aren't good, do it again.
But
same thing with a barricaded situation. If you know that there's a window where a person might be holed up and you kind of need to see what's going on inside for situational awareness, I mean, it's incredibly dangerous to send up a SWAT officer on a ladder. Incredibly dangerous. And the robot that we have with our arson bomb squad is really limited in its capability. So this actually presents a solution to help us gain information, make our officers more safe. If it's a hostage situation, hopefully get information that will protect people who are on the inside. But ultimately, a lot of this is just theoretical. We do need that community feedback. And more importantly, we do need the community support for this program.
Sean Whitcomb, what's this program going to cost?
Well, it's kind of a sunk cost, and it didn't really cost the city anything because the funds came from UWASI money, and UWASI is Urban Area Security Initiative money, so Homeland Security. We already have the personnel, and they're doing this on SPD time, and the training's been on SPD time, and they've got other workload other than the UAV.
What was that budget from the Homeland Security?
The price tag was about $82,000. And ultimately, probably about half that money went to the camera systems.
How many drones do you get for $82,000, or UAVs?
Two of them. We have two of them, two Dragonfly X6s and corresponding camera equipment. The cameras, we've got three for each, off-the-shelf digital camera. We've got a video camera, too. And then the one that's most important for finding people who are missing would be that thermal.
All right, just on the guidelines again, real quick. It shall be the mission of those personnel of the Seattle Police Department who are trained in the use of unmanned aerial systems to use this resource to protect lives and property of citizens. Who's doing the training?
The training is actually going to be in-house.
So somebody else already went and got training on it, and then they come back and they train their fellow officers.
Precisely.
And what about the oversight? Because you talk about oversight. It shall be the intent of every UAS operator to make reasonable effort to not invade a person's reasonable expectation of privacy. What's the oversight there?
The oversight's through the chain of command, and it's also through the city. We report regularly to the mayor's office and the city council. And ultimately, we are accountable to the city of Seattle and the people living here, the people working here. And so if there's any questions about use, concerns about use, hey, you know, it's not the first time we've changed policy. We're changing policy all the time. If let's say all this gets agreed upon and it does have the necessary community support and this draft scope of operations, this draft manual and policy, let's say that all does get finalized, and then fast forward a year and people say, you know, it's not worth it. We're concerned about privacy. maybe you ought to just scrap it. And we can do that too. We just think that this is important equipment. It will improve our ability to conduct investigations. It will increase safety. And we think we can get it done in a way that is not going to be intrusive, that is not going to compromise any privacy. And most importantly, we think we can get it done with community support. And if we can't, then maybe we shouldn't have the program.
All right. And Sean Whitcomb, all video and still images will be maintained in strict compliance with SPD policies and procedures. Will there be an opportunity for citizens to look at that video?
It will be consistent with our existing public disclosure policy. Exactly.
So if it's used
in a criminal case, like a barricaded situation, and that's going to go to trial, well, then that video will be available. It's no different than our in-car camera.
Sean Whitcomb, I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sean Whitcomb is a police sergeant. He is the public affairs spokesperson for and public affairs director for the Seattle Police Department. Jennifer Shaw is the deputy director of the ACLU of Washington. Jennifer Shaw, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So have you reviewed these guidelines that Seattle Times had them, SPD had them on their website? Has the ACLU reviewed the guidelines?
I have been looking at them this morning, actually, but I can't say I've done a thorough review. No, not yet.
Oh, SPD told us you had it for a while. Is that not the case?
I have to apologize. They have sent us some. They sent us a draft. We have not seen a finalized policy. I haven't seen the finalized policy until today.
Are you okay with that?
Am I okay that they...
That you're just seeing the draft now? I mean, they're only holding public meetings at this point on this issue at the Garfield Community Center tonight, so it's not implemented yet, but...
Right, right. And you know, we really applaud the SPD for really putting the effort into trying to work some of these things out through policy early on. We've told SPD and we've also told city council members that we think this is something that needs to be in a city ordinance. It's really too important to have it as a policy that can be shifted and changed through the department. It has too much of an impact on all of the people of Seattle.
So you'd like to see the city council take it up more directly. Have they done that yet?
Not yet, though we have had some conversations with city council members, and we're hoping that conversation can continue before the program is deployed.
Overall, what laws are in place to protect the privacy of citizens that may be challenged by these UAVs, these drones?
It's really difficult when we have emerging technologies that are being used in new and different ways to be able to say exactly what laws are in place. One of the reasons that we feel strongly about putting strong policies in place before technology is implemented or is deployed is that we're just not exactly sure how a court would view the use of this technology. So instead, why not sit down and think through all of the possible repercussions and work those out through policy in advance.
Sean Whitcomb said that the video and photographs that are maintained and compiled will fall under the same rules as the car cameras that are used by SPD now. So do you feel that's a good enough safeguard that you as a citizen, if you need to, can review the video and photographs that are taken from these UAVs?
Well, that's a plus and a minus, isn't it? Because it allows the public to have access because they are public records, but it also means that people who are engaging in innocent behavior have their photos or their video of them out there as a public record. And so that's actually the crux of the concern here is that we're talking about the police collecting data, collecting photographs and other information about people who may be engaged in completely innocent behavior.
Are you satisfied with the statement that said there will be no inadvertent, they will make an effort to minimize inadvertent video or still images of uninvolved persons when the UAV is being flown for those 10 minutes to a site where they think it is needed?
Well, I don't doubt that that's the intent. I'm certain that the intent is to use these for, you know, the specific purposes that are in the policy. Our concern is that sometimes things don't really follow policy. And, You know, really, the better way to do this is to require a warrant before they go up there so that there's some court oversight, and that they're only used in very, very narrowly defined situations, that any data that's collected is specific to some sort of criminal conduct or a specific kind of emergency. So it's not just that they're up there collecting data and then we'll figure out later what to do with it.
Of course, they say they're specifically not going to do that. They say the authorized missions are video photographs for investigative support of homicides or other crimes, hazmat response, search and rescue response, barricaded persons, traffic collisions, disaster response. You don't expect them to be getting a warrant for those hazmat and those other responses, do you?
And then there's a catch-all, and all other requested uses will be approved by Special Operations Bureau. So it's, that could be quite broad.
That catch-all is indeed there. That makes you nervous.
Sure.
So there's one. Do you have another? Are there some specific protections that you have not seen in here that you've liked to see? Is there another one besides that catch-all, perhaps?
One of the things that we have really advocated for on all emerging technologies like this is to build in an audit process, not just chain of command oversight and supervision, but some sort of process that specifically requires, and our preference would be an outside auditor, but that somebody be designated as an auditor to go in and see how was this device used, what information was collected, are they following all of the protocols and requirements of the policies. Is data being collected? Is it being maintained for only the length of time that they said? This was something that we advocated for around the use of the park cameras that were installed in several Cal Anderson Park several years ago. And the audit was really an eye-opener when they did it. They found out that actually the cameras were not of use to the police department at all and that there was actually some misuse of the cameras. So having that audit as a requirement up front means that you know that after 6 months or however much time, somebody will go in there and look and see how have these drones been used, and are they really fulfilling that stated mission?
Jennifer Shaw of the ACLU, who did that audit on those park cameras?
The city auditor.
And is that somebody who you think would be adequate for in this situation?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they did a great job.
All right. The FAA has those guidelines about regarding the drones. Can't be flown at night, around people or crowds. They mustn't be flown below 400 feet, must remain within eyesight of an operator as well as an observer at all times. Do you find those protections adequate?
Well, as you pointed out, those are the current rules, and who knows what those rules will be in coming years. And as drone technology evolves, and it's evolving very, very rapidly, we could find that the FAA would allow more uses. We'll also find, I mean, currently the drone that Seattle Police Department has a 10-minute battery life, but that's a really early version. Even today, you could go and buy drones that can fly much longer and carry much larger payloads. So that's going to change very rapidly. We need to put those restrictions standards and rules in place now so that when the technology changes, we have the protections and the expectation is that those privacy protections will be maintained.
Someday the ACLU will have drones that will look at what the police department drones are looking at.
Seriously doubt that.
All right, Jennifer Shaw, I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Jennifer Shaw is the Deputy Director of the ACLU of Washington. The Seattle police are hoping that you will come to see the drones in person and talk with police tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Garfield Community Center. This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 10:29. I'm Andy Hurst. Cloudy skies and 49 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high today of 53. Chance of rain this morning, then becoming partly sunny a little bit later today. Tonight, cloudy skies, chance of showers overnight, the low in the mid-40s. Clouds and showers expected tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from area schools affiliated with the Pacific Northwest Association of Independent Schools. More information about open houses, financial aid, and the range of education choices, such as the Bush School, are online at pnais.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Medical Center's 9 neighborhood locations, offering weekend and evening appointments for the entire family, which can be scheduled online through MyChart. Hours of operation and locations are available at pacmed.org or at 1-888-4-PACMED.
We like to believe that we are self-made. That is, of course, what we're hearing in the campaigns right now in America. New research by University of California economic historian Gregory Clark suggests that your place in life may be a little more predestined than that. The last name you inherit can affect your social mobility for generations, and that's regardless of where you live. In his research, Professor Gregory Clark looked at the surnames of families living in England, Sweden, the United States, India, China, Japan, Chile. He traced certain surnames over spans of hundreds of years. Professor Clark, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So what does a last name tell you about someone's past or their family's future?
Well, the last name itself is unimportant, but it does serve as this interesting trace that links people often to the very distant past. There are some people in England who their families first acquired their last name at the time of the Norman Conquest. And so it's just turned out to be a very convenient way of actually measuring the status of families over hundreds of years.
But is that true? Is that true for somebody who whose last name is Gonzalez and they live in California?
Well, it turns out that with social mobility, eventually common last names all become equivalent in status. And so most last names are actually relatively uninformative, like my own name, Clark. By 1600 in England, Clarks are average. But we can find in many societies either relatively rare names that have high or low status, or else names that indicate your ethnic origin. And so, for example, in the U.S. now, there are French-Canadian names, which belongs to an entirely white population, but which all had its origin in French Canada, and that actually are quite revealing about the social status of that group.
So what's a particular name that might allow me, might tell you that I'm a socially settled, socially established person?
Well, in America, if you were looking at surnames in America, there are certain Jewish names that would imply that you were likely to be of relatively high status. Or also interestingly, Japanese surnames, again, tend to be ones of relatively high status. And then another set of surnames we can get are, in 1923, the Congress authorized the publication of everyone's tax returns. And if we take people who showed up as paying substantial amounts of income tax and then take the rarer names from that list, those names we can predict now will still be people of relatively high social status in the United States. And those names include names like Guggenheim and Bloomingdale, names that actually some of them you would recognize.
So if I want to move up in this country, should I change my name to Bloomberg right now or Trump?
Well, what we hope is that people are not responding to the names themselves, and to ensure that. So when we study names in England, what we can do is there are lots of very obscure names that only 5, 10, 15 people hold, and that most people have no idea what the status of those names are. And so then we can actually track people looking at those names. And so the worry is that if you have a name like Rothschild, that people are somehow going to be more likely to hire you, more likely to promote you. And so, for example, in India, even common names have a lot of information about social status. And so there are, let's say, Brahmin surnames in Bengal, such as Banerjee, Chatterjee, and that's likely to affect whether you're going to get hired for a job or not, how you're going to get treated. So in this study, mainly we try and find names that don't have that obvious connotation with status in terms of tracking how much social mobility there is.
Well, expand on this notion for me to wrap this up. We can't, this is what you wrote, we can't predict the individual aspects of where you'll end up. But if we want to rank you overall in society, maybe as much as 60% of the outcome is determined at the time of conception. So determined by my last name. 60%?
With your last name just as a tracer. But what the study looks at is how persistent is social status. That is, how much prediction is there from the status of your father and mother to what your status is likely to be. And that number can run from 0 to 1. If it's 0, there's no persistence. You're on your own. If it's 1, it would be totally predicted by the status of your parents. And it turns out that the big surprise in this study is that using surnames, the prediction is that that number B is about 0.7 to 0.8 in almost all societies that we look at. And it turns out that if you square that number, it tells you what fraction of the variation in status across people is actually predictable at birth. And so that's why the answer is somewhere between 0.5 and 0.6, or 50 to 60% of social outcomes we know just by looking at surnames actually are predictable at the point of your conception. But the one thing I've got to emphasize is that that, you know, does not imply that somehow free will does not come into determining where you are in society. What it's saying is we can predict where you're going to be, but people are still going to get there through their individual efforts, their intelligence, their courage in facing difficulties. It's just that we can predict that you'll have those attributes at the point of your birth.
No, I understand that. That's why, after all, Mr. Trump, you know, he was able to do what he did through some magic. All right, Professor Clark, I appreciate you enlightening us. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Gregory Clark is an economic historian at the University of California, Davis. He did a study taking a look at what predictions can be made through your surnames.
A lot of people see Thornton Wilder's Our Town and see their town.
I grew up in a little town in North Carolina, population 800. When I read Our Town as a teenager, I was positive the play had been written about Waxhaw, North Carolina.
Wilder's biography, Penelope Niven, and How a Classic Came to Be, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That story and much more Saturday morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:38. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Asian Art Museum, presenting the lecture, Painting Sita's Garden, Mithila Artists Portray Their Lives, with anthropologist Carolyn Brown Hines. October 25th at 7 p.m. Information at seattleartmuseum.org/gardenercenter.
We have cloudy skies and a little bit of sunshine in the University District, 49 degrees right now. Forecast says partly sunny the rest of today, the high getting up to 53. Cloudy tonight, chance of showers overnight, the low in the mid-40s.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Our radio retrospective this week looks at the historic War of the Worlds broadcast. Katie Sewell, producer of the show, what was that?
Well, on October 30th, 1938, Mercury Theater on the Air did an adaptation of H.G. Wells' story, War of the Worlds, that sent people in a panic running through the streets. So I thought it would be fun to ask the question, what, were people just that gullible? You know, what was going on there?
Well, what was going on?
Well, okay, well, War of the Worlds is well known because of that panic, right? People ran out of their homes with damp towels over their faces, and they were worried about poison gases, and they loaded family into cars, and they put furniture on top of the cars and drove away. All these things. Lionel Barrymore released his horses into the wild so that they could fend for themselves. And I was reading a New York Times article that was printed the following day after this panic that recounted a man in Pittsburgh who, quote, returned home in the midst of the broadcast and found his wife in the bathroom with a bottle of poison in her hand, screaming, "I'd rather die this way than that, than like that." So anyway, so how did all of this grow out of a very simple broadcast? Let's listen to how the show starts. After the announcer says, "This is a production of H.G. Wells' story, War of the Worlds," Orson Welles uses this opening monologue.
Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied.
See, it sounds like a script, right? It's very straight, well, and play-like.
It starts with the announcer saying, "This is a production of the H.G. Wells story, War of the Worlds."
Right.
And then Orson Welles starts talking.
Yes.
Is introduced and starts talking.
Yeah, and he talks for a lot longer than that. That was just a clip. But he finishes his opening monologue by setting the scene of we're going into the play now, right? He sets the scene by saying, on that night of the otherworldly invasion, 32 million people were listening to their radios. And then the opening scene begins like this.
4 hours, not much change in temperature. A slight atmospheric disturbance of undetermined origin is reported over Nova Scotia, causing a low-pressure area to move down rather rapidly over the northeastern states, bringing a forecast of rain accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature 66, minimum 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We take you now to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra.
Okay, Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. Always a favorite thing to talk about. So where does the panic come from? Well, the music keeps getting interrupted by news bulletins like this one.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity.
So then what happens later on in the show is an object actually...
How much later on? Just a few minutes, right?
Well, they build it pretty slowly over time, actually. So maybe 15 minutes in.
The music is... They go back to...
Well, they keep coming... They do an interview with a scientist. They go back to the music. This, you know, so they're building it very slowly. And then eventually an object actually crashes into Earth. And the radio announcer goes along with the news reporter... The radio audience goes along with the news reporter out to the field, and this is what they hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but do you hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
I don't know what to think.
I mean, I could tell that's Orson Welles.
I know. So if you're listening closely, which, you know, according to news reports, people weren't, they could have heard that was Orson Welles. But the other question is, does that announcer sound familiar to you?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. He sounded very familiar to the people listening. He sounded like this guy.
The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty, mighty proud of a place it's playing in the world's aviation.
So that's newscaster Herbert Morrison, who only a year earlier famously reported from the field during the Hindenburg disaster.
Which we heard.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. And so the actor who played the newscaster in War of the Worlds, Frank Reddick, used the recording of the Hindenburg disaster as his inspiration on how to play the role. So when he said this...
The top blew! Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed.
It vividly reminded the audience of hearing this.
It's crashing terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world.
So that was a traumatic thing that people had heard on the radio. And so him sounding so much like that almost like gave that gut impulse that this is something terrible. Something awful has happened here.
Also proof again that most of us listen to the radio sort of as background. We come in, we come out of it.
Right.
What's going on? Oh, we go away.
Yeah, yeah. And if it sounds authentic enough and it hits that nerve of something that disturbed you before, oh, you know, there you go. So another reason for the panic. It wasn't just the newscasters' similarities. It was because everybody listening was already on edge. It was 1938, and the world was on the brink of World War II. And in an FCC survey in 1938, they found that one-tenth of time spent listening to the radio was spent listening to news. So they were tuning in, and they were tuning in nervously to try to find out what was going on. So the reporting segments in War of the Worlds sounded a whole lot like what they had heard on the radio when radio was covering the Munich crisis, which had happened 1 month earlier from September 12th to the 30th in 1938. And that meeting of the European leaders became the prelude to World War II. And many radio historians actually credit the news coverage of that event, the Munich crisis, as the turning point for radio becoming a trusted source for media.
Oh, is that right? They were there. They were on the scene, Murrow and William Shire and those other guys, so they were reporting on it.
And they did a really good job. In fact, a lot of people thought that they did a better job than the newspapers were doing at the time. So in some ways, it's not surprising that listeners who are only half paying attention to War of the Worlds, could hear... They hear about things falling to Earth and they just assume without any deeper thought that it must be Hitler attacking the Earth. So, and then another third major factor that led to the panic was that thousands of listeners missed the beginning of the show. They missed the announcement that it was an adaptation of H.G. Wells' story because they were listening to this.
And I heard footsteps on the ceiling. I couldn't figure out what it was.
Maybe you had a snootful.
No.
I was only trying to help.
Well, please don't.
All right.
Oh, so they were listening to other shows.
They were listening to Edgar Bergen and his puppet, Charlie McCarthy. They were playing opposite War of the Worlds, and at that time, they were incredibly popular. Like, looking at the rating shares, this ventriloquist puppet held 34.7%, and the Mercury Theater only had 3.6. I mean, it was like, it was a monster compared to Mercury Theater on the air.
Yes, my favorite thing being ventriloquism on the radio.
On the radio, I know, it worked, believe it or not. But then, when an unknown singer took the stage...
Look at you and look at me, just two worlds apart.
A whole lot of radio listeners tuned away to see what else was on. They didn't care, and they found themselves smack dab in the middle of a fake breaking news story on Orson's show. Some people actually think that the panic wasn't as big as it could have been because, in reality, most people stayed listening to Charlie McCarthy. It was like that small percentage of people who surfed on to find something else.
All right, but one other question about that, though. Didn't they... the show is following the conventions. Did they not follow the conventions of... we're listening to the War of Worlds adaptation. We'll be back in 1 minute and things like that.
Not really. I mean, a lot of dramas, when you listen to them back at that time, they didn't do that so much. They didn't do a lot of recapping. They did do one recap.
Well, they would take commercial
breaks. They did do
breaks.
One recap, but people also missed that one because of the time that they were tuning in. Yeah. So another question to ask is, was the national panic as bad as it's remembered to be? Because we think it must have, everybody was running and panic-stricken. But some radio historians, news historians, actually don't think so. They think that the newspaper was playing the hysteria up because they were trying to make a mockery of the radio medium. You know, remember that I said earlier that newspapers were feeling threatened because, one, radio was a new startup, and what was this thing that was competing with them? And two, they had covered the Munich crisis better from most people's point of view. So they had a point to prove. And the proof was, this was hugely irresponsible. People could have died. Radio can't be trusted.
This is their YouTube video.
Right. And so a lot of people think that they kept it in the papers for so long and found all these little stories from people's experiences just to keep it going, to like discredit radio as a good and trustable medium.
Well, Orson Welles had to appear before a committee, didn't he? Congressional committee at one point, I thought.
I believe so.
Yeah, he had to speak about it.
Well, and even so... despite all this, even so, when you go historically forward, because of War of the Worlds, a lot of people did not believe this was true when they heard this on the radio.
7-yard line. Wilson Kennard made the tackle. We interrupt
interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Stay tuned to WOR for further developments.
People heard that and didn't believe it the first time?
A lot of people did. I didn't believe it because radio wasn't to be trusted. You know?
This is another hoax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but of course that proved to be true.
Could we do that? I mean, could we? We talked about, I mentioned the YouTube videos and all the confusion that arose out of those. Could there be, with television? I don't think television has ever done anything of that kind of
television
quality.
Actually did do a War of the Worlds adaptation.
But they haven't had that kind of successful hoax.
Well, there were reports actually when they did that, when I remember it was like in the early 90s that some people actually did believe the TV, too. Maybe there's just a certain percentage
they followed it
that are
the
very
same
gullible.
Way.
You know, another interesting thing I didn't bring up was that you always think of Orson Welles as really thinking this through, that this was a great mastermind idea of how he was going to, you know, really build tension and cause people to panic. And the reality of it was he barely even worked on the script leading up to it. And he didn't show up to even rehearse it until very shortly before it went on the air. It was written by a different man whose name I'm forgetting right now, but I'm going to do a show on him someday because he also worked on Citizen Kane. And he was the one that did the adaptation, and Orson was just sort of, he ended up taking credit for it, but he wasn't the one that had his hands in the whole mastery of it.
Well, you do have a lot of people who say the panic was overstated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you do find that now. But you did also find more than a few people who
The newspapers were able to find some good stories. A relative actually told me that it wasn't that they were listening to the broadcast, but the neighbors ran over and pounded on the door and said, "The world is coming to an end. Run, run, everyone run." So there was always that sect of people that want to stir up a panic, spread the news on.
Well, I wonder if somebody could stir up that kind of panic today on television. I wonder what kind of conventions you'd really have to break in order to convince people that something real was happening.
Or not break conventions, but follow them.
Yes, you'd have to follow the conventions. Yes, yes,
so
exactly right.
So people thought it was credible. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. That's what I meant. I mean, on April Fool's, NPR will sometimes do an April Fool's story. But they try to fool people, but always give them enough clue. Listeners, enough clue. But I always, I always find myself wondering if maybe they are going to start tattooing earlobes with products and things like that.
Yeah, and I remember that one where they were going to abolish the postal zip codes. They did that, and that was a little bit too believable. And they got flooded with questions, and they learned their lesson from that, didn't they?
Maybe. Maybe. All right, Katie, thank you.
Yep.
Now you want to go know where we should go to lunch?
I do.
Sarah Dickerman joins us every Thursday to give us a lunch recommendation and a cookbook. Hello, Sarah.
Hey there. So I don't know about you, but I got pretty cold this week.
Yes. Yes. So you think it's soup weather?
It's chowder time. So, and not only that, but after a long, hot summer, you know, the Puget Sound oyster beds are now open for business in a big way again. So I thought I'd send everyone to Taylor Shellfish Farms. They have a little cafe in the Melrose Market on Capitol Hill. And they do a great oyster stew.
What's special about their oyster stew?
Well, I think that it's just a lot of really good oysters. So it's warm and it's a little creamy and it's filled with yummy bits of vegetable and very tender pieces of oyster. And it's just very elemental and very good and a nice inexpensive meal too, I think.
Do you have a favorite when it comes to oyster stew? I mean, do you have some favorite aspects to it that?
Well, so my problem with most chowders, and I'll sort of include oysters in that chowder world, they tend to be too gloppy. A lot of commercial kitchens add not just a little, but quite a bit of flour, so that you end up with people want a really thick and rib sticking quality. And I actually prefer them when they're looser and a little creamy, but more just delicate and full of really that flavor of the liquor of either clams or oysters. Taylor also does usually a gooey duck chowder to go alongside the oyster stew, and that flavor variation shifts a little. Sometimes it's a little Asian, sometimes it's tomato-based. So that one shifts a little more, and the oyster stew stays pretty classic.
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, at the Athenian in the market, they don't have it anymore, but when they had sort of an orientation towards Filipino flavors and Filipino cuisines, they had an oyster sinigang.
A little bit of sourness.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Oh, how interesting. That sounds wonderful. Well, the other thing that's great, though, of course, at Taylor is that they shuck their oysters, and Taylor is quite a large, it's a family-run business, but they own several oyster farms up and down the Puget Sound and beyond. So you can taste your way around different kinds of oysters, and it's a relatively good price, and even better if you go for a late lunch after 2, they knock the shucking fee off.
Oh, they do.
And then, of course, if you like something, you can take it home because it's also a seafood market.
So I can go for a late lunch and get the shucking fee knocked off? Okay,
yes,
I'll be there. Sarah Dickerman knows her way around a kitchen or two. She also writes for Slate, the New York Times, and other publications. All right, so chowders, Taylor shellfish, oysters, gooey duck stew, those all sound excellent. Is your cookbook taking us in the same direction or somewhere different?
Totally different direction today. I don't know why, but there's just this cookbook I think is so beautiful, and especially if you have someone who has a beautiful garden, I think it would be a wonderful gift as this holiday season approaches. It's by a French chef, and it's just been translated into English. The chef's name is Alain Passard, and he runs a restaurant called L'Arpège in France, and it's a 3 Michelin-star restaurant, and about a dozen years ago, he decided to dedicate his restaurant to the art of vegetable cookery. It's not a vegetarian restaurant. He still serves seafood, and I think he serves like chicken and stuff like that. But he has this garden, and he cooks all this incredibly fresh produce. And so this book is just a lovely compendium of recipes that he's put together that are pretty approachable. They don't have a lot of, cooking all sous vide or dehydrating or anything that would be too complicated for the home cook. There are some unusual varieties of vegetables that he calls for, but I think you could feel free to make some substitutions. And it's just also very beautifully illustrated with collages. So I just think it's a lovely book, very inspiring, really gets you eager to cook vegetables.
I like how you say it's a great gift book for the gardener or vegetable lover. Something to give them when they're in the middle of winter and they're missing all the things they...
Right. Well, I know people do a lot of seed dreaming, where they go through the seed catalog and, check off what varieties they want to plant. And this way they can get ready for the new year.
All right, Sarah. Thank you. The Art of Cooking with Vegetables by Alain Passard. And if you feel like some chowder in this wet weather, head up to Taylor Shellfish Store and check out some of their chowders and oysters and the like. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Dickerman can be read at sarahdickerman.com. You can also find her work at Slate, the New York Times, and other publications. And that's where she's blogging at sarahdickerman.com. By the way, Amina reminded me that KUOW's Felix Bunnell did a story about the Space Needle hoax. And that was that Almost Live, King TV's Almost Live, did a fake broadcast it was a real broadcast. They interrupted it and they said, good evening, approximately 7 minutes ago at 6:53 p.m. the Space Needle collapsed, and then they had images, and people did not know it was an April Fool's joke, and they were jammed. Their switchboards were jammed, and they had to come up and talk. They came back from the break and acknowledged the prank, but it was too late. They had 700 frantic callers, and the Seattle Times said they were disreputable and for doing that, and they had to talk about it and apologize for it. You can find that at kow.org, by the way. This Not Just In Space Needle Hoax. Talk to you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Urban Feast Catering, featuring new winter and holiday menus for all corporate events, including company parties and off-site celebrations. More information, including featured seasonal dishes, at Urban, H-E-R-B-A-N, feast.com.
Singer Iris DeMent grew up in a house filled with a lot of kids, a lot of prayer, and gospel songs. And all of it helped bring meaning to her own music.
There was a really good message that came through about the what's going on underneath the waters of life.
Iris DeMent on religion, family, and music. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That comes your way Sunday morning between 5 and 10 o'clock. This is 94.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.